Pacifica, this is Democracy Now! We're on the road in Portland, Oregon. Blackwater's secret war in Pakistan. In an explosive new article in The Nation magazine, investigative journalist Jeremy Scahill reveals Blackwater is part of a covert program in Pakistan that includes planning the assassination and kidnapping of Taliban and al-Qaeda suspects. In a Democracy Now! Exclusive, Jeremy Scahill joins us for his first interview since the story broke. Then, the University of California, Berkeley, is investigating allegations of police brutality against students protesting fee hikes. We'll get a report from inside the Berkeley campus building the students had taken over. Then here in Portland, we visit the Cannabis Cafe, one of the first of its kind in the country. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Today, we open the show differently. Because of time constraints, we'll have the day's top headlines after our first segment, an explosive new story about the private military firm Blackwater. Writing in The Nation magazine, journalist Jeremy Scahill, Democracy Now! Correspondent, has revealed Blackwater is secretly operating in Pakistan under a covert program that includes planning the assassination and kidnapping of Taliban and al-Qaeda suspects. Blackwater is also said to be involved in a previously undisclosed U.S. military drone campaign that has killed scores of people inside Pakistan. Blackwater operatives have been working under a covert program run by the Joint Special Operations Command, the military's top covert operations force. The previously undisclosed JSOC operations would mark the first known confirmation of U.S. military activity inside Pakistan. A military intelligence source said Blackwater operatives are effectively running the drone bombings for both JSOC and the CIA. The CIA drone program is already public knowledge, but the military source says some of the deadliest drone attacks attributed to the CIA were actually carried out by JSOC. The article also reveals Blackwater operatives have taken part in ground operations with Pakistani forces under a subcontract with a local security firm. The operations have included house raids and border interdictions in northwest Pakistan and other areas. Blackwater has also been given responsibility for planning JSOC operations in Uzbekistan. The Nation reports the program's become so secretive that top Obama administration and military officials have likely been unaware of its existence. Independent journalist, Democracy Now! Correspondent Jeremy Scahill broke the story for The Nation magazine. He joins us now in our New York studio for his first television interview since the article's publication last night. Jeremy, welcome to Democracy Now! Lay out what you have learned so far.
Well, Amy, just by way of background, we do know that beginning in 2006, the Bush administration struck a deal with the Pakistani government that would allow U.S. Special Operations Forces from the Joint Special Operations Command to enter Pakistan with the understanding that they were, quote, following the target, and the target being Osama bin Laden and his top deputies. As part of that agreement, the Pakistani government insisted that they have the right to, A, deny that the United States had permission to enter the country, and, B, be able to condemn U.S. actions in their country as a sort of violation of their sovereignty. But the understanding was struck in 2006. What I understand now from a military intelligence source and another U.S. military source that confirmed what I was initially told by the military intelligence source is that, in fact, there are active covert operations on an ongoing basis that are not just about targeting Osama bin Laden. What we understand now is that the Joint Special Operations Command, which from 2003 to 2008 was headed by General Stanley McChrystal, who now has been promoted and is the head of all U.S. forces and NATO forces in Afghanistan and is pushing for a very large troop increase, he ran that program from 2003 to 2008. Now it's being headed by Admiral William McRaven, who's the head of all JSOC operations. So you have, on the one hand, the allegation from these military sources that JSOC has covert bases throughout Pakistan, that they are running a drone bombing campaign that runs parallel to that of the CIA, and that Blackwater forces have been at the center of this operation, according to my sources, since at least 2007. And as part of the work that they're doing for JSOC in Pakistan, I'm told, they are essentially an intelligence cell, if you will, that is planning strikes, gathering intelligence, as well as planning operations inside of Uzbekistan against the Islamic movement of Uzbekistan. My sources said that when they are working, when the Blackwater guys that work for an elite division of the company that has been known as Blackwater Select, that they're not doing the actual killing in these operations, but rather they're doing the planning of these operations. And, Amy, what this really is an outgrowth of a trend that we saw very early on in the Bush administration following September 11th, where the Vice President Dick Cheney and Donald Rumsfeld circumvented the military chain of command, went directly into JSOC, and essentially separated JSOC from the military and started using JSOC to commit what my source said were some of the darkest acts. They also set up a parallel agency to the CIA that was called the Strategic Support Branch, the SSB. The SSB culled information resources from the CIA and the DIA, but for the first time took the realm of covert operations out of the exclusive hands of the CIA and essentially created a parallel clandestine force that would report directly to Rumsfeld and directly to Cheney. And this Blackwater program is an outgrowth of that separating of JSOC from the broader military chain of command. And that's why my sources say that there are senior figures within the military and within the administration right now that may be unaware of it because, as he said, they are not in the circle of love.
Not in the circle of love?
That's the phrase that was used twice by the military intelligence source that I spoke to. What we're seeing now, and I also talked to Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson, who was the chief of staff to then Secretary of State Colin Powell, and he described, he first of all, when I talked to him about this, said that the program would not surprise him and that he was very disturbed when he sees execute orders that are coming out saying that that JSOC is essentially above the Special Operations Command and that the Special Operations Command is essentially in a support role for these JSOC teams. So what I'm told is that this program is so compartmentalized that there are probably very top-level people that are unaware of it. And in fact, what my military intelligence source says is that Blackwater personnel that are working as part of this program and have worked as part of this program have been given rolling security clearances above their actual security clearance. And let me break that down a minute. You have guys that can work on these operations that maybe have a very low level of security clearance in terms of the amount of intelligence that they're able to see. What this program allows for is these individuals to be given temporary security clearances to have access to very sensitive intelligence, intelligence that even members of Congress that oversee intelligence matters don't have access to. And that was one of the things that concerned the individuals that spoke with me for this story.
Jeremy Scahill, what has been the response of Blackwater? What has been the response of the U.S. military, the White House, to your investigation?
Well, Blackwater said to me in a statement, and I had several back and forths with Blackwater spokesperson Mark Corallo, and what Blackwater told me is that Z Services, which is one of the new iterations of Blackwater, has only one, quote, employee in Pakistan. And as I kept writing them back and saying, what about contractors, subcontractors, affiliates, other names that I wouldn't be aware of, they said we have no operations whatsoever inside of Pakistan. My sources say that that's not true. I also received a call yesterday as I was going to press from individuals that I had not called. I received a call from Admiral Mike Mullen's office, the chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. It was a bit surprising to me because I hadn't called Admiral Mullen's office. So when a U.S. citizen gets a call from the military, especially from the chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, it's a bit jolting, and they wouldn't tell me how they got wind of the fact that I was doing this story or how they got my number. number. But I spoke to the spokesperson for Admiral Mullen, who told me that they do not comment on current operations one way or the other. I was also told by a defense official on background, not for attribution of the name of the individual, that this is not true, that there is no current arrangement with Blackwater for these types of services and that there never has been. The White House did not return emails or phone calls in the process of doing this story.
Jeremy, you point out in your article that the U.S. corporate media has largely ignored the fear and mistrust that Blackwater has generated in Pakistan. Earlier this month, the Taliban played on those fears when it denied responsibility for several bombings and, in fact, accused Blackwater of carrying them out. This is Azam Tariq, a spokesman of the Tehrik-e-Taliban.
I want to tell the people of Pakistan and the Muslim nation that the Tehrik-e-Taliban are not responsible for the bombings, but Blackwater and Pakistan's spy agency are behind them. Those who fight with the Americans are against the Tehrik-e-Taliban and have blood on their hands and will fight them to the end.
Jeremy Scahill, your response.
Well, I mean, you always have to take these kinds of declarations with a grain of salt. I mean, there's incredible propaganda, and I don't have any evidence to suggest that what that man is saying is true. But I will say this, that the Pakistani intelligence services have long had a reputation for using proxy forces to carry out actions that ultimately are sanctioned by Pakistan's intelligence agencies. So there certainly is a history in Pakistan of false flag operations, but I don't have any actual information or intelligence on the claims of the Taliban, but certainly people that have closely monitored and followed Pakistani politics, particularly the history of the ISI and other organizations, they are regularly involved with unsavory organizations that I think are classified by many individuals as terrorist organizations. So what we're seeing in Pakistan right now is certainly a situation where the Pakistani intelligence services are playing multiple sides of the equation, and I think that it would be very difficult to rule out Pakistani intelligence from much of anything in Pakistan these days.
Jeremy Scahill, talk about who Blackwater is working for or working with in Pakistan. Again, of course, Pakistan, a country the United States has not declared war on.
Right. Well, one interesting thing that happened in the course of this story is that I talked to a former Blackwater executive that is familiar with Blackwater's operations in the region. And when I asked him to confirm for me what the military intelligence source had said, namely that the Blackwater guys are not doing the actual killing in Pakistan, he told me, quote, that's not entirely accurate, and then proceeded to tell me about an arrangement that Blackwater had made with a Pakistani company called Kestrel that is headed by a man named Ali Beg. And the Blackwater executive told me that Eric Prince, the owner of Blackwater, is close with the owner of this Pakistani firm that is sort of like a Blackwater and logistical firm wrapped up into one. This is a company that works for Lockheed Martin and Raytheon and the Pakistani government and does a very robust business in war contracting and servicing the war in Afghanistan as well. And my understanding is that Blackwater is working for this company on a subcontract in a configuration that has Blackwater operatives going out as technically as advisors with these paramilitary style forces from this company, and that they are doing, as you said in the intro, border interdictions in the Northwest Frontier Province and elsewhere. And the former Blackwater executive told me that the line often gets blurred and that you do have Blackwater guys and other Westerners that actually participate in operations that are then portrayed in the international media as Pakistani forces carrying them out. And the agency that that Blackwater forces are supporting is a federal paramilitary force in Pakistan that's under the Ministry of the Interior there called the Frontier Corps. The military intelligence official confirmed the Blackwater executive's account, or at least the specific allegation that Blackwater is working with the Frontier Corps. And the benefit of this, in the words of the former Blackwater executive, is that it allows the Pakistani government to say, we're not using any Western forces to do these things, because the technicality is that they are subcontracted by a Pakistani firm that is working with official Pakistani forces.
The lobbyist for Kestrel, you report?
I'm sorry, Amy, I didn't hear you.
The lobbyist for Kestrel, assistant for.
Yeah, you've actually done shows on this individual. He's sort of a famed neocon and former assistant secretary of state for Western Hemisphere Affairs, Roger Noriega, who is well known to Democracy Now! Listeners. In October, Roger Noriega was hired as a lobbyist by this Pakistani company. They paid his firm Vision Americas $15,000. They paid another firm that appears to be little more than an affiliate of Roger Noriega's firm called Fire Creek Limited, an equal amount of money to lobby the State Department, USAID, the Congress on defense and foreign policy issues, and on services that Kestrel could provide that are of interest to the U.S. government. Another player at Roger Noriega's firm, Vision Americas, is Christina Rocha, who for years during the Bush administration was one of the top people shaping Pakistan and Afghanistan policy. She's a former CIA operations official. So this company has hired some pretty powerhouse figures that have a long history, in the case of Christina Rocha's affiliation with Vision Americas, with Pakistan directly. So it all sort of leads toward this this continued neoconservative view of U.S. foreign policy, and they picked some of the top people in that world to become their K Street lobbyists.
Jeremy Scahill, explain who is behind the drone attacks in Pakistan, who has been killed, and talk about legality here.
Right. Well, when the CIA, of course, has been running a drone campaign in Pakistan going back years into the Bush administration. When President Obama took office on January 23rd, he ordered his first drone strike inside of Pakistan. There were two strikes in North and South Waziristan, and has bombed Pakistan regularly ever since. In fact, Vice President Joe Biden, part of his strategy, reportedly is calling for an escalation of these drone strikes. This has caused some controversy because there have been large numbers of civilian deaths as a result of these bombings. But technically, the operations of the CIA need to be reported to Senator Dianne Feinstein and others on the Intelligence Committee. And there was a controversy this summer because Leon Panetta ran up to the Hill and said that he had canceled the CIA assassination program. And that sort of put drones in an intense focus on the Hill. What I am told now, though, is that there is actually, and has been for some time, a parallel drone strike program that is being run by the Joint Special Operations Command, and that these JSOC drone strikes are sometimes done with very little regard for how many civilians may die in the pursuit of one quote-unquote bad guy. In fact, my military intelligence source said to me, if there's one guy that we're trying to hit and there are 34 other people in the building, 35 people are going to die that day. And he said that part of the reason why these strikes are happening is because JSOC works on a classified mandate and they really don't care because they're not going to go to the Hill and talk to Congress about it and they're not going to face any consequences. And it's an open secret that no one wants to talk about.
Jeremy, you say that Blackwater employees may be posing as USAID workers?
I said that they may be posting as aid workers. I didn't specify any organization. I think that we have a situation right now in Pakistan where it is very dangerous for people that actually are there to aid in humanitarian projects. And this has long been a history. When you have non-civilian forces that pose in any way as aid workers of any kind, I think you create a very dangerous situation for the very well-meaning individuals that go to very difficult and dangerous countries in an effort to help local populations that are suffering tremendously as a result of war and poverty. And my understanding from the military intelligence source is that Blackwater personnel have at times posed as aid workers.
Word is that President Obama is now going to be announcing the expansion of war in Afghanistan, over 30,000 U.S. troops. Can you put this all, your expose, in a broader context?
Well, I mean, of course, you have right now you have the top two figures running, prosecuting the Afghan war from the military side are both from the Joint Special Operations Command. And I think that what we're seeing is essentially an incredible rise of the power of JSOC within the official military command structure. What we're seeing is the beginning of what is going to be a much more dramatic escalation of forces in Afghanistan, because my understanding is that as part of the president's plan that he's authorizing, there's essentially going to be an equal number of contractors that are deployed along those 30,000 or so troops that we now understand the president's going to be announcing. But of great concern, I think, to everyone in that region is that Pakistan is increasingly, the war in Afghanistan is increasingly bleeding over into Pakistan. And now with the revelation that the U.S. has actual covert operations there, these operations could be viewed, in the words of my military intelligence source, as a lily pad, a jump-off point. He called it the Jamestown of the new millennium in Pakistan and predicted that there's going to be more intense involvement of the U.S. military within the borders of a country that we have not declared war against.
Jeremy Scahill, I want to thank you for being with us, for breaking this in the national broadcast on Democracy Now! Your piece came out in The Nation magazine last night online, and of course, we will link to it. Jeremy Scahill is independent journalist, Democracy Now! Correspondent, and is a Puffin Fellow at The Nation magazine. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. When we come back, we go to our top headlines, and then inside the University of California, Berkeley student takeover and charges of police brutality. Then we visit here in Portland, Oregon, a cannabis cafe, one of the first of its kind in the country. Stay with us. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. We're on the road in Portland, Oregon. Now to our top headlines. I'm Amy Goodman. Philippine President Gloria Arroyo has placed two southern provinces under emergency rule after gunmen abducted and killed 46 people Monday. The gunmen attacked a group of people as they traveled to file nomination papers for a candidate to contest the governorship in elections next May. According to Reporters Without Borders, at least 12 journalists were among those killed. The group said, never in the history of journalism have the news media suffered such a heavy loss of life in one day. On Monday night, President Barack Obama met with his national security team to finalize plans to escalate the war in Afghanistan. Obama's expected to announce his decision next Tuesday, but the McClatchy Newspapers is reporting the president has already decided to send 34,000 additional U.S. troops over the next year to Afghanistan. Meanwhile, President Obama's facing increasing criticism from senior congressional Democrats over the war's cost. David Obey, the chair of the House Appropriations Committee, has introduced a bill to impose a war surtax. Congressmember Obey discussed the proposal on ABC News.
On the merits, I think it's a mistake to deepen our involvement. But if we are going to do that, then at least we ought to pay for it, because if we don't pay for it, then the cost of the Afghan war will wipe out every other initiative that we have to try to rebuild our own economy. That's what happened with the Vietnam War, which wiped out the Great Society. That's what happened with the Korean War that wiped out Harry Truman's Square Deal. That's what happened with the end of the progressive movement back in the before the 20s when we went into World War I. In each case, the costs of those wars shut off our ability to afford anything else.
Israel and Hamas appear close to reaching a deal to exchange Gilad Shalit, a captured Israeli soldier, for hundreds of Palestinian prisoners, including Marwan Barghouti, one of the most popular leaders in the West Bank. Hamas has held Shalit since June 2006. Barghouti is serving 5 life sentences in an Israeli prison. He's seen as a possible heir to the current Palestinian president, Mahmoud Abbas. In climate change news, a team of researchers are predicting that rising temperatures in Africa will lead to more civil wars over the next 20 years. The researchers' study is said to provide the first quantitative evidence linking climate change and the risk of civil conflict. David LaBelle is an assistant professor at the Woods Institute.
What we found was, surprisingly, that there is not only a clear effect, but a very strong effect in the incidence of civil war in Africa and the state of the climate system. And looking forward from that, we can say that for a degree increase, which is something we expect over the next few decades, you could expect roughly a 50% increase in the occurrence of civil war in Africa. Sort of a rough calculation is that about 400,000 people additional would die because of the climate change increase.
The study was published Monday in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. In other climate news, over 130 Australians were arrested Monday at a sit-in outside Australia's parliament. The protesters called on the Australian government to commit to a 40% emissions reduction in 2000 levels by 2020. An official inquiry into Britain's involvement in the Iraq war has begun. The 5-member inquiry team is expected to spend the next 18 months examining the reasons for Britain's involvement in the 2003 U.S.-led invasion and subsequent occupation of Iraq. John Chilcott is heading the inquiry.
We are completely determined to write the story fully and frankly on the basis of all the evidence we can get. And it's worth emphasizing we have complete access to the entirety of the government's records from top to bottom throughout the 9 years. And we already have seen more than enough to know nothing is being held back, because it can't be. If there was a gap, we'd know it and find it.
Back in this country, the District of Columbia has agreed to pay nearly $14 million to settle a class action suit brought by protesters arrested during a protest outside the IMF World Bank meeting in 2000. The Partnership for Civil Justice said the settlement marks the largest amount ever paid in the U.S. to compensate protesters who were wrongfully arrested. The class action suit was brought on behalf of nearly 700 people arrested at the protest. Mara Verheyden-Hilliard of the Partnership for Civil Justice said, quote, "It sends a message to every city and every law enforcement officer that there's going to be a steep price to pay for violating protesters' First Amendment rights." In economic news, President Barack Obama said Monday his top priority was to tackle the nation's unemployment rate, which recently topped 10%. The president spoke after holding a cabinet meeting.
Our economy is growing again for the first time in more than a year. And we know that economic growth is a prerequisite for job growth. But having said that, what I emphasize today is we cannot sit back and be satisfied, given the extraordinarily high unemployment levels that we've seen. We have only taken the first step in curing our economy and making sure that it is moving on the right track. And I will not rest until businesses are investing again and businesses are hiring again and people have work again.
The Consumer Product Safety Commission has recalled more than 2.1 million cribs following 4 reports of infant suffocations. The agency also said there have been 110 incidents of drop sides detaching from the cribs. Some of the cribs recalled have been on the market for 16 years. Earlier, the head of the Consumer Product Safety Commission conceded it has not been acting as quickly as it should on crib safety problems. The cribs were made by Storkcraft Manufacturing and were sold at major retailers, including BJ's Wholesale Club, Sears and Walmart stores, and online through Target and Costco. New FBI statistics show the number of hate crimes against African Americans jumped sharply in 2008 amidst President Obama's presidential campaign. The number of attacks on African Americans increased 8% last year to nearly 2,900. Hate crimes based on religion increased 9%. 2/3 of the attacks were against Jews. Meanwhile, the number of victims of bias-motivated crimes based on sexual orientation increased by 11%. In California, a 66-year-old man was jailed Monday after being accused of illegally housing homeless people on his ranch in San Luis Obispo. For the past 8 years, Dan Duvall has run a sober living center for about 30 homeless people on his 72-acre ranch. In September, a jury convicted him of 2 misdemeanor violations of building and safety codes at his ranch. Duvall was offered probation, but he refused the terms. Duvall said, quote, "I'm proud to go to jail for housing the homeless." In Oakland, a BART transit officer has been captured on videotape pulling a drunk man off a train and then slamming his head into a large window, shattering the glass.
You should get off the train. You should get off the train, buddy. Please get off the train now.
Wow, 507.
After his head was slammed into the window, Michael Joseph Gibson was charged with resisting arrest, assaulting an officer, and public intoxication. An attorney for Gibson said he plans to sue the BART Transit Agency over the incident. According to his family, Gibson has been diagnosed with bipolar disorder. Earlier this year, a BART police officer was caught on videotape fatally shooting an unarmed African-American man named Oscar Grant on a train platform on New Year's Day. Former CNN anchor Lou Dobbs has acknowledged he's considering a run for the White House in 2012. Dobbs addressed the issue in a radio interview on Fred Thompson's show.
Lou, the one way to have a voice, you've already had a big one, but another way to have a voice is in public service. Have you given any thought to perhaps running for president?
I'm talking yes is the answer, and I'm going to be talking some more with some folks who want me to listen to him in the next few weeks.
Lou Dobbs resigned from CNN earlier this month. A coalition of Latino groups recently led a campaign for his removal from CNN over his alleged anti-Latino bias in covering immigration reform. You can go to our website at democracynow.org for our interview with Lou Dobbs on Democracy Now! For a full hour. And the leaders of the group Women of Zimbabwe Arise have won this year's Robert F. Kennedy Human Rights Award. At a White House ceremony last night, President Obama praised the group's defiance of Zimbabwean President Robert Mugabe. Mogadonga Malangu accepted the prize on behalf of the group.
We deserve to have roof over our heads. We deserve to have food in our stomachs, our children in schools and the nation working. We deserve to live in dignity and free from fear. And it is our right to have our voices heard and respected. That is why I joined OZA, simply for those reasons. While Mugabe boasts of having decreased in violence, I and 75,000 strong OZA members who stand beside me have decreased in nonviolence. Our aim is to uphold universality and nonviolence for a better life for ourselves and for our children.
Again, that is Mogadonga Malangu accepting the Robert Kennedy Prize for Human Rights. And so those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The University of California, Berkeley, is investigating allegations of police brutality against students and workers protesting fee hikes and budget cuts last week. The university also will request an independent investigation by the Campus Police Review Board. 40 students were arrested on Friday night after campus police entered Wheeler Hall, which the students had taken over earlier in the day. The students were part of a statewide movement protesting the University of California Board of Regents' decision to raise tuition by 32%. Students at UCLA, UC Davis, UC Santa Cruz, and San Francisco State also took part by taking over campus buildings last week. On Monday, more than 200 students rallied at Wheeler Hall in Berkeley to protest against what they called overtly aggressive tactics by the police. Organizers say officers hit demonstrators with batons and fired rubber bullets. Independent journalist Brandon Jordan was embedded with the students inside the occupied building on Friday and filed this report for Democracy Now! From inside the takeover at Wheeler Hall.
On November 20th, at approximately 5 in the morning, students occupied Wheeler Hall, a main lecture hall at the school.
Right now, we're locked
locked in a building on campus. Wheeler Hall, probably the main campus building at UC Berkeley. There's tons of people in here. They're all, you know, shuttling around, making sure that doors are being held shut.
This is about solidarity. This is about not only students, but it's about faculty members, it's about workers, and it's about all of us being fed up with this crisis of priorities that there is. They say that it's a financial crisis, but that's not the truth. It's what they value and honor within the education system. That's the problem. We are fighting for a public good. When students come to school in the morning, they will realize that class has been canceled.
Within an hour, police arrived at the scene and broke through the barricades in the basement, attacking students inside with batons and arresting three.
They're using violent tactics. I mean, can you see my back?
Before long, crowds of supporters gathered outside the hall.
The demands that we have today, right now, are that we receive amnesty, those of us that have been acting and having demonstrations across the UC system. We are also asking that the Bears Lair, which is the only immigrant-owned business on campus, get a fair contract. We also are asking that one of the housing, the apartments that is affordable housing for students here, Rochdale Hall, remains as it always has been for a $1 a year lease to the students' co-op. And we're also asking that the 38 workers, AFSCME workers, are rehired here on UC Berkeley campus.
This action is in solidarity with occupations that have occurred so far at UC Davis, UCLA, UC Santa Cruz, SF State. We hope these continue.
Striking workers and students set up picket lines and surrounded the building while police cordoned off the entrances.
You think you need to get the class? Keep in mind, the class you're getting to, the quality of that education is being cut into. That's why people are sitting down to protest. That's what people are taking a stand against here.
Inside Wheeler Hall, the police work steadily to open the doors and get the occupiers out, while a student's police liaison tried to negotiate their demands. Outside, a heavy rain had started, but people stayed to support the occupiers. A group of Native American organizers arrived, reminding people that the week marked the 40th anniversary of the occupation of Alcatraz and showed their support for the students. Police were hampered time and again by the thousands of people who had come to support the occupation. Police asked to be allowed inside to negotiate the students' demands, but the students insisted any negotiations be held in public.
Unfortunately, I have to say that it seems like the police are telling the people outside one thing and telling us another thing. They have asked to negotiate with us and speak with us, along with the professor that has been an outspoken proponent of what we're doing for a long time, Professor Ananya Roy, and a few other administrators. And we did agree to that, but that it happened outside, that those folks remain outside, we remain where we are inside, so that the rest of the students, faculty, faculty workers that are outside can participate in the conversation as well. They're also stakeholders, and they have a right to participate, and they have said to us that they want to participate in that conversation.
But when the police refuse, the students brace themselves for police entry. Due to the presence of an unrelenting crowd, the occupiers of the building were allowed to leave after being cited. The crowd outside roared with cheers as the students were escorted out of Wheeler Hall. After over 12 hours of occupation, 43 people from inside were arrested. 40 people were charged with misdemeanor trespassing, and 3 persons arrested early in the day were charged with felony burglary charges. Although none of the students' demands were met, participants view it as a massive victory, the real prize being the birth of a new movement.
Report by independent journalist Brandon Jordan and co-produced by David Martinez with additional footage from Josh Wolfe and stills from Andrew Stern. Brandon Jordan and Josh Wolfe were both among the 40 people who were arrested and charged with trespassing. On Monday, UC Berkeley announced it will request an independent probe into allegations of police brutality during the crackdown. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. When we come back here in Portland, Oregon, we visit one of the first cannabis cafes in the country. Stay with us.
848. Head forward.
Lee Perry here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. We're broadcasting on over 800 stations on Pacific and NPR and low-power FM and college and community radio stations, on public access TV and PBS TV stations, and both TV satellite networks. On Dish Network, Channel 9415, Free Speech TV, 9410 Link TV, and on DirecTV, Channel 375. And we're video and audio podcasting at democracynow.org. Our headlines also available in Spanish for any radio station to take. Today, we're on the road in Portland, Oregon, as we continue our Breaking the Sound Barrier media tour. Yes, Portland, Oregon, which this month became home to the state's first marijuana cafe. The Cannabis Cafe is the first of its kind outside the state of California. Although it doesn't sell marijuana on the premises, it allows any of Portland's estimated 21,000 licensed medical marijuana users a space to consume marijuana in a social setting. The Cannabis Cafe's debut comes a month after the Obama administration said it would stop pursuing cases against medical marijuana patients. Reversing the Bush administration's stance, Attorney General Eric Holder said it will not be a priority to use federal resources to prosecute patients with serious illnesses or their caregivers who are complying with state laws on medical marijuana. 14 states have adopted laws allowing the medical use of marijuana. I'm joined here in Portland by Madeline Martinez. She's executive director of the Oregon chapter of NORML, the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws, which also runs the Cannabis Cafe. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you, Amy.
It's great to have you with us. Explain exactly what this Cannabis Cafe is.
This Cannabis Cafe is a place where we can gather together and be social. We are all social creatures, and one of the problems is that it always is that we have to medicate out of public view. So we needed a place that was just that, out of public view, where only cardholders could enter. So we established that. For years, I heard from people who were up at the big hospitals, OHSU, as well as the VA hospital, and they didn't have a place after procedures for hours. They were left in the cold, in the rain, in Oregon, looking for a place to be social, for someone to understand their plight. Either they found out they had cancer or some other horrible medical issue to deal with, and they had to travel home for hours alone and desperate and needing some medicine after being away from the medicine for so long. And so this, after hearing this for years and years, it prompted me to establish a place of our own. We had been having bi-monthly meetings, actually, with in the same sort of setting, but we took it to a regular basis because so many people come from all over the state, 200 at a time, to line up to get one cutting and some excess medicine. Mm. Per our law, we cannot exchange for consideration. So this is all given away, donated to me, and then donated to patients.
So when they come into the Cannabis Cafe, they are not buying the marijuana?
No. Oh, no. That would be illegal in the state of Oregon. We're in California.
That would be illegal.
In the state of Oregon, yes. And you must be out of public view. And as you saw last night, it is out of public view. You have to come up the back stairs. You were lucky you came in the front door, which we reserve for handicapped people in chairs and walkers. But they come up the back stairs. They must show a piece of state ID, or a passport is also acceptable. But you also have to have your Oregon Medical Marijuana Program registry identification card with you, or stamp paperwork, date stamped by the Department of Human Services that actually registers our program.
How did you organize, lobby for the Cannabis Cafe?
Well, I've done 10 years of work with the program. I've been there since the very beginning and helped implement it. And what I found was that if you lay the groundwork and you establish your credibility to be above question, we've never had anyone leave our building, our meetings, and complain that they're in consideration. If anyone comes in and tells me one of our members exchanged for consideration or asked for consideration, I speak to them privately, and they are asked to leave, and their membership is revoked, and they can't return to our meeting. We insist that patients cannot be taken advantage of. Many of these patients are desperate, and people go out and say, give me $300, I will grow for you, and they never see the money or the person again. And it's really sad because they're left to their own devices. When you get your card from the state of Oregon, you're not given a clue. That's not their charge. It's out of their purview. So they don't tell you where to get a plant, where to get medicine. So you're left to your own resources, which generally includes the black market. My view is, let's capture the revenue from the black market and let's pay for health care in our state. You know, we know that people aren't growing hops in the forest because alcohol is no longer, you know, illegal, but they're growing marijuana. And I think we should take back that power that we've given to the criminal market and establish it. Let's tax and regulate. 357,000 Oregonians consume cannabis by government statistics, ONDCP. And it's really a tragedy that that money is being just squandered. We have two state troopers on the I-5 corridor here in the state of Oregon. I'd like to pay for more. I'd like to have a safe state. And it's really sad that our legislators don't look beyond what they're doing. They keep continuing the same process and expecting a different outcome. And that's a definition of insanity.
What's the response in Portland to the opening of the cannabis cafe?
You know, it's been really positive. We have many of our patrons are actually neighbors in the Northeast Portland area. And they've come and they said, we're really happy that you're here instead of a bar. Because so often, unfortunately, people consume too much alcohol. And they go, they urinate on someone's lawn or, you know, they're misbehaving or, you know, they just get rowdy. And it's a big improvement. We're done by 10 o'clock. We close the doors. We're quiet. We keep to ourselves. We don't bother anybody. We're actually planning a volunteer trip down Deakum to clean up the street.
Deakum is the street
yes,
that the
street.
Cannabis
yes,
cafe
exactly.
is, we visited last night. Madeline, talk about your own experience.
Well, I'm a retired peace officer. I worked for the Department of Corrections. I'm a PTA mom, a grandma, and I've consumed cannabis my whole life. It works for me especially well for my anxiety and depression. I never understood, but the first time I consumed, I titrated cannabis, I could feel it immediately. There was a click. Well, come to find out years later, we have cannabinoid receptors in our brains. And that's what was happening to me that I didn't realize. People with fibromyalgia, they feel like a light switch go off in their nerve endings. And it's just amazing what it does. I have degenerative disc and joint disease.
And what is it?
Degenerative disc and joint disease. And it's not going to get better, obviously. And so living with chronic pain, my other option is to have Vicodin. Vicodin is really a hard painkiller for me. It leaves me in a drug-induced stupor. And I prefer a better quality of life. I have 5 grandchildren and 4 Pomeranians. And, you know, I like enjoying my family and my home, but I can't on the harsh pharmaceuticals. It's a death sentence for us, Amy. If you have to take them for the rest of your life, they destroy your vital organs. And that's what's happening. Our government is insisting that we use the pharmaceuticals that enrich them. And that's a real tragedy because marijuana is the safest medicine known to man. There's never been a lethal dose of marijuana.
Talk about the other people. Last night when I went into the cannabis cafe, people were sitting around together. And among the ways they were consuming the cannabis, describe the process.
Well, you know, one of the things we're trying to introduce people to is vaporization. It's so much safer for us than burning a plant matter. The carcinogens, you don't want to take those in. And so what we're doing is we're teaching them to use this machine that heats the medicine to 375 degrees Fahrenheit, but it doesn't allow it to burn. You were there, you saw it captures the vapor of the THC.
A big plastic bag.
Exactly. Yes, it is. It's a big plastic bag, and it heats up, and the vapors go in there, and then you titrate it, push it against your lips, and you consume it. And we think it's safer. We're showing them different methods. One of them, the volcano that I demonstrated, is $600. Not affordable for someone on fixed income. So we have other vaporization systems that are cheaper. That's more affordable, let's say. And that's what because the best vaporizer is the one you can afford, because then you'll use it.
How many people come to the Cannabis Cafe now?
Well, you know, we have our regulars, and we've gotten as many as 194 people a day. They come in after work, after you left. It even got busier.
And how late is it open till?
It's only open till 10. We stop letting people in about 9 o'clock, close the doors, and just say, that's it for the evening.
Well, Madeline Martinez, I want to thank you for being with us. We will show you a tour of the Cannabis Cafe on our website at democracynow.org. As we wrap up now with our last segment, the Obama administration has promised to begin moving the 700-odd men held in the Bagram prison in Afghanistan into a new $60 million facility by next month. But in a video released by Brave New Films today, two men who were held in the notorious detention center ask how much of a difference this will make when it's unclear why people were arrested in the first place. Abdelrakib was released this August after being detained for 2 years and allegedly tortured. Upon his release, he was told he'd been mistaken for a Taliban spokesman. His brother Nur Rakib, imprisoned for 10 days in 2007, was told he, too, had been picked up on the same mistaken assumption. The brothers were interviewed by filmmaker Anita Sridhar last month. This excerpt begins, features both brothers, beginning with Nur Rakib.
Cruelty and terror. They would speak with insults. We have brought you. We will bring your father, your brothers, your tribe. We have brought you now. You must speak regardless. They were scaring us by saying, you have 5 minutes. After 5 minutes, we will take you to the torture chambers. I would vomit for quite a while. They were facing us with such conditions.
If I am guilty, then punish me. If I deserve imprisonment, then imprison me. If not, let me go free. Let me go. I spent 2 years here in Bagram. Others have been 3, 6, or 7 years. And at the end, you tell them that we made a mistake. You destroy people's homes. I don't have a house now. I have 4 children. I have 4 cows, and they have all been sold. They had nothing to eat. There was nothing at home. They take the people from their house and imprison them. So the people develop this opinion that Americans are terrorists. They have been treated unjustly, so they seek revenge.
That from Brave New Films, and you can go to our website to learn more about them. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report, as we continue our Breaking the Sound Barrier tour. Today, we go to Astoria, Oregon, and then move on to Olympia, as well as Bellingham, Washington, where we will be tonight. Tomorrow, we will head on to Vancouver and Victoria, B.C., and then we will come back down on Friday to Port Angeles, Washington, to Bainbridge Island, to Seattle. We'll be at Town Hall on Friday night, and on Saturday morning, we'll be in Everett, Washington. Then we head Saturday night to Boulder, Colorado. On Sunday, we'll be at noon in Minneapolis. Then we'll head on Monday to Washington, D.C. We'll be at Busboys and Poets on Monday night. On Tuesday at noon, we'll be at the Philadelphia Free Library. And on Wednesday, December 2nd, at 7 o'clock in the evening, we'll be at the Barnes & Noble in Tribeca on Warren Street. Before, on Friday, the whole Democracy Now! Team heads to Copenhagen for Climate Countdown, for what some are describing perhaps the most important diplomatic summit in history. Democracy Now! Will be there on for 2 full weeks, broadcasting from the streets of Copenhagen, from the suites, from the summit, bringing you all of the voices, as many as we can, from people all over the world who are attending. We will also be bringing you 2 days of specials during Thanksgiving. On Thursday, we will bring you Buffy St. Marie, a special with the great Native singer and songwriter. On Friday, we'll be bringing you our special with Studs Terkel. A lot of information has been revealed recently about the great broadcaster, the oral historian, the Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist. Now, more information has come out on how the FBI followed him for decades. So we're looking forward to bringing you those two stories on Thursday and Friday of Thanksgiving holidays. You can go to our website at democracynow.org again today for a web exclusive as I visit the Cannabis Cafe in Portland. Our Breaking the Sound Barrier tour will also take us to the Seattle airport on Wednesday, the day before Thanksgiving. I look forward to seeing travelers there. This is Democracy Now!, produced by Mike Burke, Sharifa Gokadus, Aaron Mate, Anjali Kamat, Nicole Salazar, Steve Martinez, Hani Masood, and Robbie Karen. Special thanks to Dennis Moynihan, as well as Chuck Skurich, and to Julie Crosby and Karen Renucci, Brenda Murad, Anjali Kamat. all the folks at Democracy Now! Who make Democracy Now! Happen every day. Our website, Democracy Now!, is where you can sign up for Twitter, for our email lists. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.